is a real meeting, isn't it? I would like to call the House Transportation Finance Committee to order. Not used to having these evening meetings. We have presentations this evening from the governor's administration, and I believe they have had a arm wrestling match to see who goes first, so we'll see who won. Please come forward. It must have been a tie.
So break the tie.
All right. Welcome to committee. Whoever's going first, please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, I'm Joanna Clyburn, Commissioner of Minnesota Information Technology Services. Thank you for the opportunity to present the governor's supplemental budget recommendations.
Our agenda includes the following. The first item I'm going to cover is the Mindler's IT budget request, and Commissioner Doman, who is with me, will cover the second two items. The fiscal year 19 projected funding needs for the Mindler's IT is $45.3 million. However, only $19.9 million is projected to be available in the DVS technology account. The resources that are available in FY19 include the carry-forward funds from the current fiscal year, the $8 million appropriated by the legislature for Mindler's maintenance and operations funds for the FY19, and the 1.9 fee revenue for motor vehicle transactions performed by DPS that is dedicated to the technology account. The governor's supplemental budget recommends providing $25.4 million in FY19 for continued development of the improvement of the Mindler system. This is a mix of general funds and special revenue funds, as outlined in the slide behind me. Special revenue funds would be raised through a $2 technology fee that would begin in FY19 for all motor vehicle and driver's transactions. Under the proposal, this fee would remain in place moving forward until a stable, ongoing source of funding for maintenance and operations of both Mindler's vehicle system and the FAST driver's ID system. The $25.4 million included in this request addresses the Mindler's IT budget gap in the next fiscal year in various funds various components for the Mindler's IT project, including IT contractors, Minute and DPS staff who are working on the Mindler's project, as well as the development and testing environments necessary, and the disaster recovery and cloud services that we need to ensure in the event of an unforeseen disaster, we can recover quickly our functioning of these systems. Legislative oversight over how this money is spent will be ensured through the new Mindler Steering Committee created this session, as many of the members of this committee are aware. As you all know, this committee would have the power to stop funding if progress on the project was not being made and the milestones were not being met in accordance with that statute. This funding would resolve several things, but it specifically provides fundings that will enable Minute and DPS and our IT contractors to resolve existing deficiencies in the system, fill the gaps that need to be filled in regards to the needs of our functionality, and develop the new features that our stakeholders have asked for. The work on the system will be prioritized in partnership with those stakeholders and the legislators on that Mindler Steering Committee, and we'll have clear view of that prioritization process. Some examples of the functionality that we would be developing using these funds include the specialty plate transfers, the enhanced editing capability that the deputy registrars have been requesting, title processing enhancements, as well as transaction calculations, accuracy checks to make sure that the calculations that are being handled are in fact accurate and according to statutory guidelines. Members, thank you for the opportunity to present the governor's supplemental budget recommendations related to the Mindler's IT. I specifically want to thank Chair Torkelson and all the members for this committee for your partnership as we're working forward to improve and complete the Mindler's project. and the fast driver system. I know it has not been an easy road, and I am grateful for the opportunities that I've had to, along with Commissioner Doman, to speak with each of you. Now I'm going to turn it over to Commissioner Doman, who will present on the two other budget items requested before you today.
Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mona Doman, and I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. Thank you, Commissioner Clyburne. I'm going to be presenting the Governor's recommendations on the Public Information Center and then the reimbursement to the Deputy Registrars. And so the first item is the Governor recommends funding to support the Driver and Vehicle Services Public Information Center. The budget request, as you see on the slide, includes $7.296 million from the general fund in fiscal year 19, $5.973 million in fiscal year 20, and $4.783 million in fiscal year 21 from the driver and vehicle services special accounts, revenue accounts. The amount for fiscal year 19 is higher to account for one-time costs such as technology, enhancement software, and equipment. In fiscal year 20, $5.973 million represents the ongoing annual costs. And then in fiscal year 21, the amount is reduced as the department anticipates a cost savings from decommissioning the main frame, and this will offset the need for additional funding in that fiscal year. The general fund appropriation is needed for fiscal year 19 because special revenue funds were used to fund the MNLAR's emergency request signed into law last week. This request will improve the quality of customer service by adding 63 permanent staff to timely respond to steady volume of customer calls and emails. The current staffing level is not sufficient to handle the volume of calls coming into the department, which leads to Minnesotans not receiving the assistance that they need and that they deserve. The staffing request is based on the pre-MNLAR's call volume, using what I am told, and I have staff here to help explain it if you have questions about how we came to that number, but it's using the Erlang C calculation for call centers. The next slide shows, the graph on the left shows the volume of incoming calls from January 2017 through February of 2018. And the graph shows the spike that occurred after the MNLAR's launch, and that's the blue line in the middle. The blue line represents the total number of incoming calls. The orange line shows the number of those calls, that were able to be accepted into the contact center, and the green line shows the actual number of calls that were handled by an agent. The difference between the green and the orange lines is the number of callers that were able to be assisted by the self-help options, or they simply hung up because they didn't get their call answered. The graph on the right shows the volume of emails received during that same time period. The blue line represents the number of emails, while the red line represents the number of days to respond to those emails. And I would add that all emails are responded to. It's just the number of days that it takes us to get the responses out. And that it sometimes fluctuates based on the number of call volumes that come in, because if people don't get their calls answered, they sometimes revert to an email to try to get their questions answered in that respect. We anticipate that there will be additional spikes with the implementation of the fast driver system and the availability of Real ID come this fall. Currently, we have 43 staff to answer calls regardless of the call volume. As the number increases, the total number of calls that are answered goes down. And when this occurs, there's also a corresponding increase in emails as frustrated customers attempt to get their questions answered in a different way. Call center levels have dropped from the high point, but it is still unacceptable to us and to the governor and the frustrated Minnesotans who can't get their questions and calls answered. The PIC is critical in supporting key stakeholders such as deputy registrars and law enforcement, but it is also the first call when someone needs assistance with their motor vehicle transactions or, say, their driver's license. And we have highly trained specialized staff in all of these areas to answer the basic and the most difficult questions that come in, and then everything in between. And the slide that you're looking at now just gives an example of some of the calls or the categories of calls that we answer. And I'd just like to offer a couple of examples. So we might get a call about how do I get my driver's license and schedule a road test? Or is our lien listed on the motor vehicle record. Or I just got a DWI, how do I get my driver's license reinstated? Or what are your office hours? Or how do I get an endorsement on my driver's license? And they're complex, they're simple questions, and sort of everything in between. And so more information about the PIC is included in the handout that I hope that you all received, which is the titled DVS Public Information Center Investment Need. And hopefully that will answer questions that you have, but we'll also be able to answer questions. So the next slide is the second piece to, the third piece to the governor's recommendations for the supplemental budget. And it includes $10 million from the general fund to reimburse the deputy registrars for actual incurred costs related to the implementation of MNLARS. DPS recognizes the challenges that deputy registrar offices have faced since the launch of MNLARS. We know that this has been a difficult and challenging time and that they have experienced unexpected costs, and we support a reimbursement plan to provide financial relief. The governor's bill does not have a reimbursement formula to determine how much each deputy registrar would receive, and we at the Department of Public Safety commit to working with stakeholders to establish that reimbursement process. I, too, would like to thank you for the opportunity to present the governor's budget proposal tonight, and I appreciate the work that all of you have done that has gone into this project to this point, and we look forward to and commit to working with you as we move forward in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioners. I have a question from Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this one is for Commissioner Clyborn. Just in relationship to a few weeks ago, you rolled out a fairly large update attempting to fix quite a few of the issues that MNLARS has faced at this point. Can you tell us how that rollout has gone? Is it solved some issues? Has it brought more issues to light, et cetera?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm going to have Joan actually come in and talk to the specifics, because there's some things that occurred with that went really well, and there's a couple of things that were, I would consider, a little bit of a hiccup. So I'd like Ms. Red Wing to testify to that.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your answer.
Great. For the record, my name is Joan Redwing, and I'm the acting CVTO of DPS. And our 111 release delivered over 50 major fixes to the application. It also delivered our refund capability, which was long sought after. All of those fixes and features held up after the rollout. There was a couple issues that were a challenge. One was, after we did the 111 release, we had to clear our cache. I don't know if everybody has used the browser, but we had to go through a second step to clear the cache. So it wasn't the traditional cache clearing that the deputy registrars were used to. There was another step in addition to that to clear cache for this release, since it was so major. And a lot of the deputy registrars did their normal cache clearing when they saw that step in the instructions. And subsequently, we sent out a lot of communication, like there was a two-step process to clear that cache. Otherwise, it looked like the release was very broken. And so that was a communication issue, not a release issue. It did make was a little bit rocky. And so next time, we will make sure that there's we called it now extended cache clearing, that we will legitimately call out when that has to happen. A subsequent issue also was that periodically in places where there was one transaction that you could do serially after another, some people experienced that they had to do it in two steps. They'd do one transaction and then close out that transaction and then do another one, when they used to do it in two steps. So so those are something that happens that after the release. But things that went really well is we were able to clean up a lot of fixes. We were able to close a number of our workarounds, and get that workaround number smaller and smaller. And it's our goal is to get out of the workaround business, get the deputies out of the workaround business, and very dedicated to make that happen. And so we continue to move in that vein.
Follow-up for St. Petersburg.
Yeah, yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one follow-up question, which is, so what are you hearing as follow-up feedback from the deputy registrars in this follow-up?
Ms. Redwing.
Mr. Chair and members, we are hearing that once we got through the communication challenges around the release, we're hearing that the release is stable, and we are hearing that we did also have a periodic slowdown and one outage after the release, a 15-minute outage where we overran an image file that's been fixed and repaired. But for the most part, we're at 98% availability for the release, which is industry standard for a website, and that we are working to communicate, to work on our communication, because sometimes we stand in our way that it's really not necessarily a technical problem, but it's a communication problem. And we are also working on our next release, which we were able to we've upped our quality assurance and are including deputy registrars in our post-release checkout and now also in our user acceptance testing to drive that quality further all the way from a DVS through the deputy registrars and other stakeholders as well as dealers who are interested in testing with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question for Commissioner Dolman. Looking at the call charts, there's this January spike. Can you, January looks like January this year, if I'm reading that fine print correctly, can you tell me why we had a sudden spike in, or apparent spike in, I guess it's actually February of 18, at the end of those charts? This is with the Public Information Center.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to ask Thomas DeVita to come forward. Thomas, can you help us with that? He's in charge of our call center. I could speculate, but I think he might be able to explain in more detail.
Thank you. Please identify yourself for the record.
Chair members, for the record, I am Thomas DeVita. I am the Support Services Program Director for Garber and Vehicle Services. So, yes, you do notice a spike occurring in January and February of 2018. There's usually a lull that occurs during the holiday period, but we are also experiencing some situations with citizens that are doing online transactions and the ability for those transactions to be processed and stickers to be issued. So those are being resolved through through our partners with Minute. And we anticipate that once those issues are resolved, the call volume should sustain a little bit.
Well, thank you for that answer, Mr. Savita. And then looking back to prior to the Myanmar's rollout, you know, the performance or the rate of answering these calls seems to have been quite low for a long time. Am I reading that chart correctly?
You are reading that chart correctly. I would say that, so I joined the Driver and Vehicle Services, I believe, at the end of January last year. In stepping into this role, one of the first things I noticed was the number of calls that we receive that we are unable to handle. And that's simply just because of the number of staffing available to answer those calls. You see between the blue line and the orange line, there's a very big discrepancies in the number of calls that come in than those that actually reach agents.
Well, thank you for that. It just it seems a little surprising to me that we weren't asked to try to address this issue a year ago or a little over a year ago when it seems like an ongoing problem. Any other questions from members? Oh, here we go. Rep. Sam Daniels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious on the call center. There's looks like we're more than doubling the staff to answer phone calls. And for 17 years, I was in a call center myself. My wife in a call center for a little over 20. And I'm just curious How many calls per day, per person? Do we have something roughly there? And since this is hopefully a series of hiccups that will hopefully subside after a while, will those numbers go extremely down once the system is working properly?
Mr. Suita.
So just to clarify the questions, you're wondering about the number of calls answered per agent?
Right. My wife manages two call centers, one in Minneapolis and one in Faribault, and they take tens of thousands of calls a day, so there's always criteria for that, and there's a list of, well, maybe 35 or so criteria here. There, so in her business, it would be they have maybe 40 cases going on at a time, each, and not everybody's training the same thing, but they have call metrics. Northern Tool use call metrics. Russ Consulting use call metrics. I'm just wondering kind of what that is, and after the spiking is done of all the you know, trying to find out where my title is and all the questions here, what about 63 people can go down to maybe even less than the 43 you currently have?
I'll start with just addressing the 63. Before I worked on preparing this recommendation that went up to the commissioner's office, the 63 is based on pre-Minlar's call volumes, so not related to the spike in the Minlar system today. So what we... So with that said, the complexity of the DDS call system, there are 24 different phone lines that feed into the call center, and then from that, agents, depending on their training level, and if you were to refer to the back of your handout, it spells out the different categories, and that really relates to the amount of training that the agents have. And there are 54 skill groups that the calls get parsed into based on the menu options or the phone numbers that are requested, so that those calls go to agents that are specifically trained to handle those calls. In addition to that, due to the complexity of the call levels, the call volumes really vary by the amount of time it takes to handle, anywhere from a simple, may I book my driver's exam at 2 minutes 56, all the way up to some of the stuff that deals with the deputy registers or the DL agents. Those calls, because there's usually a citizen on the other side of the counter and we're assisting them in completing their transactions, those can go up to 7 minutes 32 on average.
Okay.
And follow-up of Sam Daniels.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And do we expect those numbers to go down greatly once the hiccups are resolved? We're more than doubling the staff, and hopefully in a year or two all the hiccups will be done. We're not hiring this full-time, and then what I'm wondering is my wife uses, my company uses temp services for a lot of that, and there takes about 2 days of training, and basically they have a script that they go from, and it goes pretty fast. But just wonder if that's going to be a temporary thing or planning for full-time.
Mr. Suvita. Or Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Daniels, these calculations were based on pre-Minlars, so our anticipation is that these call volumes will remain relatively the same as pre-Minlars once the hiccups, as you refer to, are gone, and so that's the reason for the number.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I had actually, Mr. Chair, the same question you did, and I guess I just want to follow up because the number of incoming calls in February 18 is still significantly higher than in 17, and so I'm just wondering if there was something more than just the holidays or something else that you can identify.
Well, Mr. Suvita.
Yeah. Some of the things that have been pointed out is on the roadmap, issues like the ability to transfer special plates. That's one key issue that we get a lot of calls about as well. So there are many things that you've heard from the deputy registers are similar things that we're hearing from our citizens. So wherever there's a deputy register that's stuck with an issue, there's likely to be a population group that is also calling on that same issue.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, and just one last follow-up. So do you have, on that blue line, is there, are you shooting for 200,000? I know there's a lot of variables in terms of the numbers of calls that you get, but do you have particular goals, and is that the I mean, that seems to be the low point. Is that kind of what you aim for?
Mr. Savito.
The aim in the staffing request is to definitely meet the call average based on pre-MNLARS phone numbers or pre-MNLARS volumes. To account for the additional spikes that we are experiencing beyond that, as well as the sort of annual increase that we've seen from year on year, the budget includes several IT factors in order to create efficiencies in order for us to better utilize the staff that we are given in order to answer more volume utilizing a number of staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I might have missed this. I was a few minutes late, but the 63 permanent staff, is that in addition to the current 43 FTEs, or is that inclusive of that? So that's question one.
Commissioner Dolan.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that is in addition to the 43.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad I stopped to get a snack because I'm in sticker shock over the 63. So the second question is, what are the hours of operation? Is there a time when those calls spike during the day? And then I have one follow-up to that.
Mr. Savito.
The permanent operating hours for the DDS Contact Center are from 8 to 4:30 daily. Currently, we are on extended hours with mandatory overtime, working from 7 until 5:30 daily. Typically, because the volumes far exceed the capacity of the call center, the phone lines are pretty much full from the time they're turned on until the time they close at the end of the day. There is a spike in the number of calls that come in, especially around the lunch hour, and particularly on Mondays. So we can see that based on the data that is produced from the phone system that tells us where the calls land every day.
Representative Barr.
I'm just wondering if any thought had been given to, with all the newfangled technology we have, I believe it was 173 registrars around the state, where maybe we would ask the registrars to pick up some of those calls and do some kind of overflow and not have to hire 63 permanent staff, and look at some other alternative where we could even pay the registrars to help handle those calls, because I feel pretty confident they could do it with nominal training. So I would just pose that question, if we've looked at any other alternative other than 63 permanent staff.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barr, we know that those discussions are going on. I will say that there is a complexity to a lot of these calls, and it's certainly not that deputy registrars could not handle those with the proper training, but we would have to work through those discussions and see what that training might look like if that were to occur.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I share Representative Barr's concerns. 150% increase in the number of people in the center. Now, help me out, Mr. Chair, or maybe Commissioner, but there was discussion at a previous meeting. Representative Nash had a bill and suggested that about 40% or more of the responsibilities were going to be transferred to the deputy registrars. Can you refresh us, Commissioner, on what that is, and why would the call volume be going up when the responsibilities around this are going to the deputy registrars?
Commissioner Dolan.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, I was not at that hearing, but I understand that there was discussion about 40% of duties going from DVS to the deputy registrars, but we are not certain where that number came from, because we have not spoken about a percentage of workload moving from our office to their offices. What we have spoken about is that that we are answering about 40 to 42% of the calls and emails that come into the department.
A follow-up, Representative Drazkowski.
Well, Mr. Chair, it seems to me, and Commissioner, you know, I think Minnesotans expect that this $93 million you spent so far, plus another $10 million, plus another $45 projected, that we're going to get something that's going to be more efficient, and apparently we're getting something that's going to be less efficient if we need to hire more people in order to tell Minnesotans what they've got and how it works. So, Commissioner, with all due respect, this isn't acceptable. It's just not acceptable. And I think some people need to go back to the drawing board, but
Another question, if I could, Mr. Chair. I did come in late, a $2 technology fee, and Commissioner, is that then to fund the 63 positions, or is that to help fund the Minlar's IT finish up? And if so, is it going away after 3 years or 2 years?
Commissioner Dolan.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have Director Olson come up and respond.
Welcome to committee. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your answer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Don Olson, and I'm the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. The $2 technology fee is to replace the fee that we used before to collect funds to be able to develop the system. The fee is attached to motor vehicle transactions, all motor vehicle transactions, and driver's license transactions. And it is dedicated into a special technology account where the funds are used solely for the development and maintenance of the system.
So Mr. Chair, and Director Wilson, so prior to us embarking on this development of Minlar's 10 years ago, we didn't have a technology fee, as I understand. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we didn't have a technology fee, and it was... And this was a fee that you kept coming back to us for, to give us more and more and more because the system's still not working. And we came back another couple years later, and guess what? It's still not, we're still not there. We need to continue it another 2 years or 3 years. I'm just dumbfounded at this, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
I believe that is all the questions we have this evening. Thank you for presenting the governor's budget. We look forward to further conversations in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The first bill before us this evening. Oh, I'm sorry. I almost tried to cut off MnDOT. I didn't mean to do that. Well, maybe I did, but I shouldn't have done that. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott Peterson from MnDOT. Thanks for the opportunity to come and talk to you about the governor's recommendation for a supplemental budget for the Department of Transportation. We just have a few items on our list, and I'll go through them as quickly as possible in the interest of time. The first thing that the governor have on the list is $850,000 for a study of extending the North Star line up to St. Cloud. This afternoon in Transportation Policy Committee, there was a pretty robust conversation about trying to extend passenger service up to St. Cloud, and this is what we think is about how much it would take to do an adequate job of looking at potential ridership, scheduling, environmental issues, capacity, and come up with some kind of a cost estimate for extending that service up to St. Cloud. This line and this service was studied pretty extensively in 2002, and it was updated in 2010 when this is looked at in some detail. All that information needs to be updated given changes in the existing train traffic volume and the ridership changes that have occurred since then. The second one is $1.8 million in general funds and $7.2 million in trunk highway funds to replace two aging airplanes that MnDOT owns. One of these planes is 35 years old and the other one is 23 years old. These planes are used to transport executive branch employees and MnDOT employees around the state and while they conduct official state business. The age of the planes means that they're frequently in for repairs, which means they're often out of service when they're needed, and the state isn't able to take advantage of the value that these planes provide for transportation for state business. And so the proposal is to sell the two existing airplanes and buy newer airplanes, not necessarily new airplanes, in order to minimize the ongoing maintenance expense and reliability issues. So, and just so the committee's aware too, whenever MnDOT employees use their planes for official business, there's a cost analysis that we conduct There's always an attempt to fill the plane with as many employees as we can that go to the destinations. We also combine, whenever possible, the responsibility for some of our aeronautics office employees to do airport inspections when we're traveling around the state, so they can get better value from each of the trips. And although this is quite expensive, I think it's important to recognize the amount of value that this provides to the department and allows people to get out into the far corners of Minnesota and conduct the state's business in a very efficient manner. Moving on, the state tribal training funding, this is $200,000 in the current biennium and then ongoing. And this is something that I'm very familiar with, because this is something that we run out of the Government Affairs Office at MnDOT. This is a very innovative training program that we have had great success with. We have trained in 5 years since we started the training a little over 2,000 state employees. The training has been recognized by the Ash Center at the Harvard at Harvard University as one of the innovative government programs in a national competition. It also won a state government innovation award from the Humphrey School and the Bush Foundation, and just a couple weeks ago was a finalist in the state government innovation contest that is sponsored by the governor's office. So it's widely recognized as highly effective. And one of the things that makes it so effective is this is training that's developed by tribal people. It's put on by native folks. It includes personal testimonials, the experience that people have had throughout their life, and the struggle that Indian people have had to kind of fit in with the culture and society that has kind of evolved in Minnesota. And we hold it at tribal locations. And one of the key things about the training is that we focus on the government-to-government relations, because Indian tribes have unique legal status in the state of Minnesota, and very few state employees before they take the training are fully aware of what that means for how we conduct our business on tribal lands and with Indian people. And if I recall correctly, we get a very positive, like, top of the chart rankings from about 95% of the people who take the training. One of the reasons that we're coming to you to ask for this general fund appropriation is because up till now, the department has borne the cost of kind of the back office operations that are necessary to put the training on, while it's also being extended to other state agency employees. Very high demand for this training, and so part of the funding will also be used to develop online training so we can make some of the benefits of this training available to even more people. The next one would be a request for debt service to cover the $40 million bonding, trunk highway bonding request that's in the governor's capital budget proposal. This is for our facilities capital management program. MnDOT owns about 1,075 buildings across the state of Minnesota, located at 269 different sites. The buildings that we are proposing to spend this money on have been evaluated and the at the very detailed level, and all the condition ratings for all the building attributes are entered in what's called the Enterprise Real Property Facilities Condition Assessment Program. That evaluation's occurred on 884 buildings. And of those 884, 53 are rated as poor, 21 are rated as a crisis or emergency in need of funding. And the projects are prioritized for investment based upon need. When I say evaluated at a very detailed level, so they look at the roof, the exterior structure, the quality of the air, the age and the functionality of the air handling system, the plumbing, and those kinds of things, and each one gets an individual evaluation. The projects that are coming up soon in our program are an Eden Prairie truck station addition and rehabilitation, Mendota Heights truck station rehabilitation and addition, a new headquarters building in Virginia, a new truck station in Jordan, an addition to our headquarters in Windham, and a new truck station in New Wheaton. The next item I have here is money to pay the City of Virginia, a grant to the City of Virginia for costs associated with relocating utilities associated with the department's relocation of Trunk Highway 53 near the City of Virginia. And folks who've been on the committee for a while may remember that the department was required by the owner of the land underneath Highway 53 as it approached Virginia to relocate the highway, which were the terms of the easement under which it was acquired in the early 60s. As part of that project, the city also had to relocate all the utilities that were in the Trunk Highway right-of-way in that area too, because all that area is going to be mined. We had a very short time frame because of the challenge in trying to find a suitable corridor to relocate that highway to. And as a result, we had a very condensed construction schedule, which required close coordination. It's very challenging terrain up there. If you've been to Virginia lately, you know basically the approach from the south is basically all mine or soon-to-be-mine territory. And if you come around from the east side, it's an old abandoned mine. And the route that was chosen was to build a bridge across an abandoned mine pit. And that rock that's adjacent to that mine pit is some of the hardest rock on earth, as I understand it. So all that created challenges for both the road construction and the utility relocation. The city received $13 million in state funds to pay for the relocation, but because of all the factors I just mentioned, it had significant cost overruns. And the City of Virginia borrowed money, and this, as I understand, puts a pretty significant hardship on the city. And in addition to the money that they borrowed, they still owe the Department of Transportation about $1 million, just because that utility relocation project was rolled into the Trunk Highway construction project contract, so that we could achieve the coordination that we need in order to finish the project on time. And if you ever get a chance to go up there and see the bridge, it was really quite a successful project. So finally, I'd just like to point out that the pension funding that will be needed from the Trunk Highway Fund, and I know there's a lot of talk about pension reform, and so from the Trunk Highway Fund, the governor's asking for about $2.3 million in 19, and about $4 million, $5 million, $6 million in the next 3 years in order to address the pension deficits. And that's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regards to the plane purchase, so the statute that you referenced, 360.024, I did look it up, and it does say that the commissioner shall charge users of air transportation services provided by the commissioner for direct operating costs, but it excludes the pilot salary and aircraft acquisition, which is kind of unusual, which means that all agencies pay for gas, and that's pretty much it, other than some fees. Seems like a future bill waiting to happen there. But doesn't that seem a little bit silly for us to take out of trunk highway funds, the funds that we need for our actual roads and bridges and other things, to take $7 million out in order to pay for an aircraft that's going to be used for all the agencies? And why wouldn't we try to fund the acquisition of that plane with something that everybody can be participating in, rather than always taking it out of the transportation fund? Is there a rationale for that?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Petersburg, it's a very good point. That's something that we've talked about at great length. The general fund portion of our request reflects the proportion of the amount of use of the planes that has been for other than trunk highway related business. And the trunk highway related portion of the request is to support the proportion of the use of the planes that was for trunk highway business. And so I think although the changes that you suggest are very logical, and I, you know, often think that would be a better way to do that, right now we're not allowed to do it. That money would come from the Trunk Highway Fund in either case. We would just pay for it on an incremental basis, or as opposed to a lump sum as we're requesting in this particular request.
Follow-up, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may be right there that it may come out of transportation funding. It wouldn't necessarily have to come out of trunk highway funding for various other things that the Department of Transportation uses. They have other funding that could come out of it as well. Trunk highway funds, because they are so limited to what they can be used, it just seems like it's a little difficult for us to pull those funds out. So I'll be reviewing this into the future, but thank you for your clarification.
Representative Runback.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're looking at the pension reform page, and Mr. Peterson, I think I heard you say that that's coming out of the trunk highway fund. There's, and so I'm just really wondering why.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Runback, the employees that are that work for the state of Minnesota that are paid from the trunk highway fund, you know, part of the cost of their employment is their pension and the state portion of the commitment to their pensions. And so I think the logic behind it is that it's a trunk highway expense, because that's where I get paid from, and actually most of our employees get paid from, and that's where our health care benefits and other benefits are paid from. And so this is just a part of the total cost of employment for our employees that do trunk highway work.
So Mr. Chair, yeah, what you're saying is there's an apportionment that you're talking. There's some state executives that work on the trunk highway system. There's some judicial employees that are paid on the trunk, or work on the trunk highway system. Is that what you're basically saying?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Runback, no, what I'm saying, this is for employees that work at the Department of Transportation that are paid from the trunk highway fund.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Peterson, so the slide doesn't say that. It's saying that there's all those levels of state employees, state executive, judicial, and legislative branch employees that are, you know, to whom their pension is being paid out of the trunk highway fund.
Mr. Peterson, Representative Nelson, I believe, can.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. While I don't serve on the Pension Commission this year, but in past, and I believe the pension bill that's coming forward, there's an increase in all across all the state government and all the employees, the employer share. There's an increase in the employer share to help with the sustainability of the pension funds. And I think what they're talking about here is the funds that for the MnDOT employees, that's the employer share of the MnDOT employees that they have to pay for the sustainability of pension funds. It's not judicial employees. It's not Department of Health employees. It's not any other employee except the employees. That piece there is just for the employees that work for MnDOT. It's the employer share for the pension sustainability fund.
Thank you for that explanation. I believe Mr. Peterson is nodding in agreement.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I apologize, Representative Runback. It is misleading the way it's stated. It's. I think that refers to just in general the governor's total request for funding for pension.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Mason has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. How many planes does the state own? And one other question. Didn't we recently just buy a new plane?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mason, MnDOT currently owns 4 planes, I believe, and a relatively old Bonanza, which isn't pressurized. And I have to say that the last time I got a ride in it, the pilot admonished me that if the door just swings open, don't be concerned. We'll just land and shut it. Don't try to reach for it. So it didn't come open, but that might be something he does to make all the passengers sit back and relax. But and then we have another newer Bonanza that we purchased not too long ago. You're correct. I don't know. Maybe 10 years ago, I lost my mind. There was some concern about that purchase that you may recall, and that we had decided to purchase another Bonanza, and there was some interest in having us buy a Sirius airplane, but this is primarily to haul people who do the airport inspections around. So there's equipment. The stuff is not really specifically set up for passenger transport, although if there's just one or two people that need to use a plane, that it's a plane that can be used for that purpose. It's just a one-engine plane. And then there are the two King Airs that we have now. One's a 6-passenger, one's an 8-passenger, and those are the ones that we're asking to replace.
Follow-up, Representative Mason?
No, thank you.
Question from Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was kind of similar to Representative Mason's question. So, Mr. Peterson, can you get by with one less plane? Take two old ones and cash them in and bring that number down. Or how often are the airplanes used,
Mr. Peterson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gostkowski, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but if I remember on the number of times that it's used, but I think we had transport about 1,200 people a year in the two planes.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Gostkowski,
and Mr. Peterson, we've got technology moving ahead at warp speed, less need for face-to-face meetings. These airplanes have been around prior to the adoption of a lot of that technology. It would seem to me that we would be able to get by with less airplanes, but certainly that's not happening here. Mr. Peterson, could you share with the committee a schedule of those planes over the last 2 or 5 years or something like that? Can we get a kind of a schedule about how often they've been used?
Mr. Peters.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gostkowski, yeah, we can provide that information to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you repeat what the MnDOT share of the pension reform bill is, and then also where on page 2 in the handout that's included?
Representative, or Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barr, it's not on page 2. It was a relatively late addition to the presentation, and that's why there's the confusion over the one bullet and the lack of information. But the numbers taken from the governor's proposal are $2.3 million for 19, $4.3 million for 2020, $5.2 million for 2021, and $6.1 million roughly for fiscal year 2022.
Could you say this, excuse me, Mr. Chair?
Representative Barr.
Thank you. For the second number, it was 4.
Mr. Peters.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barr, $4.3 million.
Okay. And one last question. And which,
Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Which fund is it coming out of?
Mr. Peters.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barr, the Trunk Highway Fund.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Question. In regards to the tribal training program, I understand that you do train representatives of state employees from other agencies. Has there ever been a proposal to bill the other agencies for this training that MnDOT does for these other agencies?
Mr. Chairman, we've had those conversations. There's been some reluctance to increase the billing to the other agencies because there's a feeling that it may discourage some people from approving their employees for attending the training. So we've tried to keep that number as low as possible. And to this point, we've been trying to find other means to fund it. This is the second time, I think, that we've come to the legislature asking for this. We've been going round and round on this. So we continue to be able to train MnDOT employees, and we still think it's a very significant return on investment for us, even in this current arrangement. The thing that we can't find the resources to do is to fully fund our development of our online training. There are so many people that are wanting to take the training and so many people that need the training, frankly, that we just think the online training is the best strategy that we have in order to reach that number of people.
Thank you. I don't have any other questions. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you.
First on the list, we have House File 3339, Representative Lucero.
Thank you.
Representative Lucero, welcome to the testifier's table. I will move House File 3339 be passed to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So this is related to septic tanks. Now, a good portion of Minnesota, of the homes and businesses, are still on septic systems. And when a septic system fails, and it happens to fail, or there's an emergency frozen ground, something like that, that occurs during a period of time when there's weight restrictions on roads, there is a separate process that's required by the municipality that this emergency is occurring in order to license or get an exception to be able to go on the road in order to help the homeowner or the business with sewage backing up into their home. What my bill seeks to do is to create an exception and essentially treat septic tanks similar to the exception we give to garbage trucks and other similar vehicles where there's a an urgency to the issue at hand. And we heard this in Transportation Policy Committee, and there were some legitimate concerns from several stakeholders. So since that meeting, or that committee, stakeholders got together and came together with language that is before you in the A18 amendment. And this hopefully will create the peace in the valley. So I would, Mr. Chair, move the A18 amendment.
Representative Lucero moves the A18 amendment to get the bill in the shape you would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. Your bill is amended. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have a testifier who will explain the new engrossment.
Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Koski. I am a contractor located in Mille Lacs. I'm also a member of Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Association, so I'm representing the septic contractors of the state. This amendment, I did want to thank MnDOT for working on the amendment and to address their concerns, but also work with us to hopefully move this forward. The language in the amendment that was proposed by MnDOT, it is our understanding that the nature of the amendments are as follows. Sub-item B talks about a 10% variance to gross vehicle weights found in chart 169.824, which is the gross vehicle weights that we base how trucks are built, essentially, and how much they can haul on the roads. The sub-item C talks about the need for, if you don't need permits underneath the rules listed, you would not need any additional permits. The sub-item D discusses that we would not qualify for winter load increases, and sub-item E talks about that we would have to follow what grids are listed, the weights on there, that we can't exceed those either. So from our perspective, these proposed amendments work for us, and they would allow us to help our customers when they do have backups or do have sewage leaking out on the ground somewhere, to be able to serve them during spring load limit restrictions.
Thank you. I don't have any member questions. Anyone else care to testify in the audience for or against this bill? I do not see anyone. I will renew the motion that House File 3339 is amended be passed to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. You're on your way, Representative.
Thank you.
Oh, there he is. Next up, we have House File 4158, Representative Anderson. I will move your bill to be passed to Capital Investment. Welcome to the committee.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and members. Long day today, long evening, and thanks for hearing the bill. This bill was an attempt to find some funding for what I feel to be is a pretty important safety aspect in the state, and that's some rail grade separation crossings. I've tried for a couple of years actually working a couple of years to get some funding for a crossing between Glenwood and Alexandria. The bonding committee was up there this summer, and later found out that if it's over a trunk highway, you can't use geo bonding to fund a project like that. So this is, excuse me, an attempt to take a look at the situation and set aside some funding for what I think is an important aspect in the state, which is taking a look at all of our rail grade crossings that may need some separation. And I'm partial to one of them, but I would, what the bill does, Mr. Chair, is set up a funding mechanism for some trunk highway bonding to fund rail grade separation crossings in Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. I do not see any questions for you this evening. Oh, Frank, Representative Martin.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. Again, we've talked about using trunk highway money for other purposes besides trunk highways, and we had an idea to split the costs between for these rail grade crossings with the railroad companies, and of course they strongly objected, they lobbied, and we don't have that proposal in front of us anymore. So I just hope we could consider that, because I think this should be a shared responsibility between the public and private sectors. So I don't have an amendment, just something that the governor has proposed in the past, and I think that is the best way to fund these grade crossings. So MnDOT did a study, and I think we have several hundred priorities, including what you're laying out. So just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. I see, Representative Salk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there some, am I missing it, maybe a place that this money will be held and or system for accumulation? How does money get contributed into this fund, or is it just done on the books kind of thing? I don't think I find it. And maybe I'm just not reading.
Representative Anderson, do you want to take a stab at that?
Well, finding the funding would be your job here on the committee, but the legislation does set up a fund where it would be held and prorated out, and the MnDOT would determine who would get the appropriations. But finding the money would be up to you.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Given that comment, Representative Anderson, do you have any suggestion for what would be a good amount of money to start the fund out with?
Oh, gosh.
Representative Anderson.
The project that I'm partial to is about $12 million, and I think we had a couple other projects in bonding earlier, one up in Moorhead, I think, and Staples or Wadena. Wilmer was mentioned as well. They're expensive. They're expensive projects, and it's going to take significant funding to do that, but again, the safety aspect, I think, In this one, there's emergency vehicles that can't get across. The trains are always speeding up or slowing down, and it can be a 15-20 minute wait at a major a highway. And so the need is there.
Representative Mason.
Thank you. To the author, if we come up with the money, are you willing to vote for a bill that will accomplish that task?
Pardon?
Okay. I'm not willing to take it out of the current fund, so we'd need to come up with extra money. Are you willing to vote for a bill that will increase the funding for this particular project?
I would take that under advisement.
Senator Anderson.
I would take that under advisement. I think I know where you're heading with that. And,
go ahead.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one of the other things you might think about, since there is a MnDOT study specifically on the rail grade crossings that's already done some analysis, that somewhere here maybe we could reference that as this fund is set up, that we reflect some of the plan already in place.
Yeah.
I believe that was advice, not a question. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is,
I lost your mic. Oh, yeah, too. You're in stereo tonight.
Okay. So thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have, I like how you have the things that they must consider. I think if I'd like to work with you before it goes to capital investment to get some language because what I've learned on some projects on MnDOT is they don't always address an area that requires pedestrians or people who bike to get across it. They haven't necessarily planned for that. And it just, we need to make sure that people get, can get across for it. And there's certain requirements on how you can do things. So it's better to plan up front if there's a need. And then the other area is if there, if a community wants, and it's appropriate for it, a no-whistle zone. I can't remember what that's called. But just to plan for that up front, because once you place those, there's requirements to where they can go and can't go and medians and all that stuff. So it would just be a good thing to consider up front so it's what the community wants for the long haul.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. I don't see any other representatives that care to give you any advice tonight, Representative Anderson.
It's news country time.
Would you care to make any closing remarks?
Well, thanks again. And we have contacted the railroads and such and asked for help with this, and so far they've not been forthcoming. But again, I just think the topic needs to be looked at and addressed, and digging these can be trunk highway bonding. I'd encourage some kind of formation with the funding up to you folks. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. I will renew my motion on House File 3528 be passed on to Capital Investment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? You're on your way. Next up, we have House File 3528. The chief author is unable to be with us, so we have an able substitute. Welcome to committee. The motion on this bill is to pass it on to Ways and Means. Representative Rare, to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3528 is in response to some issues and stories that we've been hearing around the state dealing with older vehicles, 6 years and older, that have had accident damage or having been in floods. And because of the way the law was written, they are not always required to get a salvage title. And people are buying vehicles that have some type of damage or inefficiencies that they are not aware of, which has created some hazards on the roads. Some vehicles have not had working airbags or even any airbags reinstalled. A lot of our vehicles, they estimate there's about 7,000 vehicles in Minnesota that came from flooding areas because of hurricanes from a few years back, Katrina and such. And part of the worry is now with the major flooding from the last two hurricanes in Houston and in Florida, that because of this loophole in Minnesota law, that many of these vehicles could end up in Minnesota again with a clean title, and people would be unaware of the risks they're having, where it could be computer systems that wouldn't work because of corrosion in the future, anti-lock brake systems that might fail. We heard the many stories. You'll see in the fiscal note, the estimation is that there would be approximately double the number of salvage titles in the state per year, which would in turn double the number of inspections that would have to happen. But we would also be there'd be fees that come along with that. So I don't know all of the details on the fiscal note, having just taken this bill over a day ago. So if you have questions, I'm hoping staff can help me answer. But with that, I would be open to questions.
Thank you, Representative Rarick. I'm going to interrupt you for a moment because I'm going to have to rewind the tape. I made the wrong motion on the last bill. I used the number of your bill instead of the number of the bill we're actually voting on. So the last motion was to pass House File 4158 on to the Capital Investment Committee. Any objection to correcting the record? I see none. The record is corrected. Thank you for that. Getting ahead of myself again. While we're taking a little break here, Representative Johnson, do you care to move the minutes of the last meeting?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do. I would like to move the minutes for March 27th.
Thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are approved. Thank you for that. We're back on track, Representative Rarick. I have a question for you from Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to wait until after any other testifiers if there were any.
Are there any other testifiers that would care to testify for or against this bill?
Is DVS here? So if I would just request that you, I was going to ask some questions, but I think what I'll do is phrase them into statements, and if I'm incorrect, if you could just flag me rather than going back and forth with questions, just flag me to correct me if I'm incorrect. So, Representative, actually, this question probably is applicable to you. So, Mr. Chair, my first question to the testifier is,
Representative Lucero,
can you explain how, as Representative Eric explained, there were some television programs that have aired coverage on how out-of-state vehicles that were in floods, how is Minnesota, what is the process, what's happening in order to watch these titles?
Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your answer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Henderson. I'm the Vehicle Services Program Director for DVS. It would be my team who would be handling these inspections. What Minnesota does, my team does, on an out-of-state title, is we check NMVTIS, the National Motor Vehicle Title Information System, on every out-of-state title. If a vehicle from out-of-state has a flood damage, for example, brand on it, then we will maintain that that brand on the Minnesota title.
Oh, Senator Lucero.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and we met beforehand, and I asked a very similar question, and it wasn't clear to me exactly what, and I share the concern. If Minnesota's current law allows for vehicles that are out of state that have been in a flood to be washed through Minnesota to have that eliminated somehow, that's concerning. But as I've been asking the question beforehand and even now, I'm not clear as to exactly what in-state law is allowing that to happen, and I'm not clear how this change in the proposed language is going to actually solve that. So when I read the existing law, I read this as there's three parts to the existing law. Subdivision 1, you can see Section B and Section C in the file there, the bill there. And I'm seeing that an insurer that's in-state who acquires ownership of an in-state vehicle through payment of damages, that's going to be have to have a salvage title. I'm seeing that a person who acquires ownership, so this might be an auction site, of an out-of-state vehicle, that's going to have a salvage title. And then I'm seeing the third section, C, a self-insured who has a vehicle in the state of Minnesota that suffers damage, and that's going to have a salvage title. When I read this, the only loophole that I'm seeing is if you have a self-insured who's out of Minnesota that sells to an auction site in Minnesota. That's the only scenario that I can see under current law that would allow for a vehicle that is 6 years or newer or greater than $9,000 to be able to walk away with a non-salvage title. And in our prior conversation, that it sounded like we agreed. So the value of a vehicle is established based on national standards. So you could have a vehicle that suffered a damage in New York, or a vehicle that suffers in California or Minnesota or others. The value of that vehicle is part of the industry's common process to establish that vehicle. When it comes to establishing the estimated repair of a vehicle, that's established using that state's, my understanding, that state's local labor costs, and then the costs of parts that are new, okay, new parts. So the reason that those two established values are important is because you could have an identical car that's having identical damage in New York, for example, versus another state that might have lower costs, that the one in the higher state will be salvaged quicker, if that makes sense. Because the value is would be common, and I'm saying this as because this is important to understand what's happening here, is that under this scenario, then if this bill moves forward, because the current cap is if the vehicle is 6 years or newer, or greater than $9,000 of value, by removing this, we're blowing that open to any year vehicle. And any value whatsoever. So if this happens, then a 15-year-old vehicle with an estimated value of $1,500 involved in a fender bender, maybe a rear end or something like that, that might crack a plastic bumper, might dent or bend a bumper, but nothing else happens to the integrity of the vehicle, and the person that did the rear ending, their insurance company then would pay to the person that was hit because the damage exceeded or was equal to at least $1,500, that vehicle now has to have a salvage title. Another scenario, a 9-year-old vehicle valued at $4,000 with collision insurance that's keyed. Somebody walks by, maliciously keys the vehicle, smashes the windshield. Because it has collision insurance, that the new paint job, the new windshield, and maybe some other ancillary damage that's done to it, the insurer might pay out. That's now going to require a salvage title. A third scenario, a 15-year-old vehicle salvaged, valued at $3,000 covered with comp insurance that suffers hail damage, and the insurer pays out and acquires the vehicle. That hail damage, which may or may not ever be repaired, because I've seen vehicles that the hail damage, estimated value of the work can be enormous. That's going to have a salvage title if this happens. So the additional thing I'd want to put forward is when it comes to inspections, I've been through these state inspections on salvage titles, and correct me if I'm wrong, member from the DVS, the representative from DVS, the purpose of the inspection is to ensure that parts used on vehicles that are repaired are not stolen. Is that the purpose of the inspection?
Mr. Henderson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lucero, that is correct. The purpose of the inspection is to deter the use of stolen parts in the reconstruction of the vehicle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucero.
So the inspection, there might be a misnomer out there, having been through this, the purpose of the inspection does not evaluate the quality of the workmanship. It doesn't evaluate anything else other than the form that's obtained, that's filled out by the person who did the work. They have to self-declare the parts that they put on the vehicle. They drive to inspect one of the, I'm guessing it looks like there might be a dozen inspection sites around the state. They have to wait in line. They hand the state inspectors what they've self-declared, and the state inspectors validate that the parts that were declared are indeed, and you have to include the receipt of where it was purchased to validate that it wasn't stolen. And so things such as framework, if the vehicle had a warped frame and had to get the frame straightened out, that's not declared. Paint job, for example, that's not declared. It's parts. There are no before pictures. Nothing is taken to the inspection. It's not required. So the inspector validating that parts weren't stolen doesn't see what the before was. So the inspection is only as good as the person that's doing the declaring. Because repair work is estimated based on average labor cost and new parts, and because the salvage title is based on estimated work repaired and not actual repairs, that creates a market that's been around for decades. And the market is vehicles that are salvaged, such as the fender bender or hail damage, otherwise that is based on actual cost to repair, that then is but then somebody performing that work doesn't use new parts. We have yards of used parts. The work performed is significantly less. That this creates a market that's going to be interfered with now with this. So I just submit that to members of the body, that the fiscal note's going to increase, it requires two additional sites statewide with two additional employees per site, that all vehicles that have damage that, because all salvage titles are not equal, and because we're going to require all in vehicles now to go through there, it just is something I don't think. It expands the scope of what happens with the current process. And while I think it may or may not, I'm not convinced that it's even going to solve the problem that was highlighted, it certainly is going to have enormous unintended consequences, broad and far-reaching, beyond the scope of the original problem. So, members, I just have very strong concerns with the bill as written, And I think it could be more narrow, and I can't support the bill as it currently is.
Any comments, Mr. Henderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The department actually is taking no position on this bill. We will administer the law as it is written, one way or the other. And Representative Rosero listed some plausible scenarios, but I really can't comment on them in the hypothetical.
Mr. Henderson, if I could ask you a question. Do you think the bill does what it's advertised to do, and that is to keep Minnesota free of flood-damaged vehicles with a clean title?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe that it does.
Thank you for that. Anyone else care to testify? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Henderson, Representative Lucero's comments and question with you made me wonder about the utility of this section of law to begin with. Is it even accomplishing its objective?
Mr. Henderson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, I'm not certain I understand your question.
Representative Drazkowski. Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair. You had testified that the purpose of this section of statute is to prevent the use of stolen parts in repairing these vehicles. Representative Lucero's discussion with you, as far as I could keep up with it, suggested that that the way things happen, that there's really no way that you're able to track that. I think you mentioned that you're not able to track. You don't even check in on this auto repair people to see if they use stolen parts or not. How do you actually prevent the use of stolen parts if indeed this is a part of statute and that's the intention of this statute? How are we certain that this law, whatever it's intended to do, is actually doing that?
Mr. Henderson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, when a vehicle comes in, owner brings a vehicle in for an inspection, they'll have a declaration of the parts, the major parts that were used as part of the reconstruction of the vehicles. They're required to have receipts, legitimate receipts for those major parts. Those major parts then are checked by the inspector that they were in fact used in the repair of the vehicle. Earlier it was mentioned that perhaps a declaration is not complete. A major part was not listed. The inspectors were also looking for mismatched parts that were used on the reconstruction. And so if there is a mismatch, they'll question the owner that this major part appears to have been replaced. Could you please explain that? And we'll seek more information, more detail, more documentation from that owner.
Representative Drazkowski, a follow-up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Henderson. Mr. Henderson, it seems to me that, I mean, there's costs to Minnesotans for requiring them to go through this salvage title process. It seems to me that we could maybe accomplish this prevention of these flooded vehicles without... I mean, do we really need to worry about the low-value vehicles? I mean, the low-value flooded vehicles. Does that at some point there's diminishing marginal returns for this? I don't know. Just a comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Anyone else care to testify to the bill? I don't see anyone else. Representative Salk has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you help me understand, as you allocated the scenarios, can you explain how, if you never mentioned the issue of flooded vehicles, and I can imagine how easy it is to bring one in and somehow get it through the system and end up with a title. You know, if you're criminal, you're criminal, you're not, there's nothing about filling the form in wrong or signing, I mean, there's lots of opportunities to fraudulently do it. Is there, what kind of system is there, and maybe you can help me, is how does a flooded vehicle get found, and in what way
is the transaction. Because the issue is we want the public to know. I don't care if somebody buys a flooded vehicle. I just want the buyer to, and for the system to mandate that at least they be told that it's a fraudulently represented vehicle. I'm sorry, I don't know. I'm sorry as to who I should ask. I'll start with you, probably.
Yes.
Mr. Henderson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, an out-of-state vehicle which has been damaged in a flood would typically be purchased from that owner from an auto insurer as part of a settlement. Then it could be sold at an auction, and it could end up in Minnesota. As I said earlier, every out-of-state vehicle that arrives in Minnesota, flood damaged or not, is we check it against the National Motor Vehicle Title Information System. All states participate in the NMVITA system. All insurance companies participate in the NMVITA system. And if when we see that a vehicle, say from Colorado, which was damaged in their floods a couple of years ago, has been flood damaged by Colorado, we will maintain that brand in Minnesota. So we've informed the Minnesota buyer that this is in fact a damaged vehicle.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, to respond to
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to respond to that, so as we've heard, it both prior to this committee and in the committee now, it's not clear to me how this washing is occurring. My understanding from the intent of the bill is the product of seeing some television programs, the news aired, but as we know, not all facts are understood or clearly articulated in broadcasts. And it's my high concern that the assertions that might have occurred in these broadcasts are not actual. And as DBS is testifying, they check all titles when they come in. So it's not clear to me how Minnesota is being used to wash titles. But what is absolutely clear, this is going to have a broad impact to vehicles on the lower end. That part is clear, and I'm not sure that this actually is going to solve or change anything other than expand the burden on these lower end vehicles who those who don't have as high income are typical within that market. It's going to drive the price up to repair, and it's going to push down the value of the vehicle if it involves an fender bender and has a marked title now, and that's going to squeeze the margin and it'll disincentivize auto body shops from repairing vehicles because the margin might not be there anymore, and vehicles that are perfectly good, fender bender, hail damage, things like that, doesn't compromise the integrity, are going to be pushed out of the market, not repaired, and instead scrapped. And I have a high concern with that.
Anyone else scared? Representative Bernard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero, I appreciate your comments, and one of the things we haven't talked about is people in this, and there's so many people around the state where they don't have a lot of transportation or transit options that they actually need a car. And so when people have gone around the, can't remember what they were called, they just got disbanded, but the Office of Economic Security, they had gone around the state and they asked people, and this is greater Minnesota, not the metro area, but they said, what is your biggest barrier to economic security? And it was transportation. And so I wouldn't want this to have negative consequences on people who actually need to have access to cars that are quite affordable. So I don't think it's quite ready. I don't think it's ready for prime time. I'd hate to have it affect people negatively across the state.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I must be looking at a different bill, or it's been amended, because this doesn't change anything at all for low-value cars. It's if we think that's not working, then we need to draft a different bill. But the comments about that really have nothing to do with this bill in front of us.
That's
not true.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lucero.
My comments absolutely deal with that. The definition of late model is 6 years and newer, so 0 to 6 years. The definition of high value is $9,000 and greater. And so what we're saying is, under present law, late model, so 0 to 6 year old vehicles, and vehicles valued at, let me turn it around, vehicles that are over 6 years old, and vehicles that are lesser than $9,000 in value don't have to go through this inspection process and have a salvage title. That's why the scenario I'm talking about, a 15-year-old vehicle that has that's valued at $1,500, has a rear end as a fender bender. Because it's only valued at $1,500, is going to very quickly, because the estimated value to repair is based on new parts and market labor, it'll total out easier. But then the actual repair might be, if it's plastic, to, quite honestly, I've seen some bonding agent and a hairdryer to take out a dent in a plastic bumper or to fix a crack in a plastic bumper. You don't need to buy a new part. And that's how the actual repair is far less than the estimated repair, and therefore that vehicle can be resold without having a salvage title, without having to go through state inspection, and be back on the road, safe and full of integrity, to somebody who can only afford a $1,500 vehicle.
Representative Brazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Henderson, is that $9,000 value based on the value of the smashed up vehicle, or is it the value of the vehicle before it's smashed up?
Mr. Henderson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drozkowski, the value of the $9,000 is the established generally by the National Auto Dealers Association guides on prices of vehicles, and it's before damage.
Just looking for that information and trying to process it, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Henderson.
Representative Grazkowski. Any other questions? With that, I will renew the motion that House File 3528 be passed to Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Bill is passed and moved down to Ways and Means. Oh, I'm sorry. We have some more business. We have a bill, Representative Erdahl's bill, House File 3301, that we held over for possible inclusion. I would like to instead pass that to Ways and Means, and that is my motion that House File 3301 be passed to Ways and Means. Any questions or comments? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed by the same sign. Erdahl's bill is on its way to Ways and Means. We are not going to deal with the Nash bill tonight, and the Lehman bill has been pulled from our agenda. Our next meeting is tomorrow at 1 p.m. in this room. This meeting is adjourned.